Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. And I know these sometimes are tedious, reminder that you can subscribe to us on Google Play, Stitcher, iTunes, all sorts of other places that have podcasts that I probably should know but have forgotten. We're going to talk about what's going on with the Democrats today, and we're joined by Gideon Resnick, who is a national political reporter for The Daily Beast, who covers all things Democrat. So thanks for joining me, Gideon. I appreciate it very much.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Well, I want to talk about the booing in California. I want to talk about Mayor Pete, but I have to get this off my chest here. And I mentioned right before we started that I had a little bit of a riff about the rad trads counting boobs, which probably means absolutely nothing to anybody. You know, the rad trads are these radical traditionalists. They're sort of gathering behind the tattered banner of illiberalism that's been hoisted by Sohrab Ahmari, and basically saying, you know, we're done with this democratic constitutional, you know, pluralism and all that civility and decency stuff, and we're going to join together in the denunciation of David French. You've probably heard about this controversy, right?
Now that you have given a little bit more context, yes, I've seen some tweets that have alluded to this,
right.
And I've seen a Game of Thrones reference that I think
okay.
is the heart of what you're talking about.
Right. We got to get into the. Are you a Game of Thrones guy?
So here's a huge issue for me. I saw probably five seasons, and then I gave up a little bit, and I let this entire cycle of this most recent season completely pass me by. So I have like maybe a fifth grade knowledge on the scale of, you know, K through 12.
So you probably have not seen the total of 1 hour and 48 minutes of nudity, including orgies, incest, and rape, right?
I don't think collectively.
Collectively.
If that is what's being measured from start to finish.
It rings a bell, though, right? So, and I don't want to have any spoiler alerts. However, your wife is not, like, expecting a baby soon, right? Because I would just advise you and anybody else, if you haven't seen the end and you're expecting, probably hold off on naming your child Daenerys. Just saying, okay, without giving anything away. It would probably not be a good choice. Okay, the reason we're bringing this up is because these radical traditionalists are obsessed with David French, which is really bizarre because he is as socially conservative as any prominent conservative pundit out there. He's as you know, right to life. He's down the line, you know. But apparently, his sin is that he's got multiple sins. He's emphasizing religious liberty rather than religious coercion. You know, the new Shiite Americans out there, and of course, he was anti-Trump. But the reason I wanted to mention this, and I had this in my newsletter earlier today, Matthew Schmitz is the editor of First Things, which, believe it or not, Gideon, used to be a serious journal of intellectual thought. But before they got into all of this, and he's lashing out at David French because David French watches Game of Thrones, and sort of the context is, you know, French is, you know, discussing the ridiculousness of evangelicals supporting somebody like Donald Trump, who's actually was on the cover of Playboy and has a cover, you know, has a Playboy magazine hanging on his walls. I mean, this is not the worst thing he's ever done, but Schmitz sort of you know seized on that and he tweeted out. He says it's strange to hear this criticism coming from French, who proudly watches an explicit TV series, The Game of Thrones. Okay, now you got to sort of follow the logic, or air quotes around logic here. So he actually counts the number of explicit elements that David French may have seen on Game of Thrones to basically say, look, evangelicals who voted for Trump can offer a stronger defense for their compromise with vulgarity and obscenity than French can for his public celebration of a show that once would have been banned as pornographic. So this becomes the, we're okay supporting Donald Trump here. This is not nearly as bad as David French watching Game of Thrones. And he says, assuming that French has seen every episode, he has seen 134 nude bosoms, 60 bare butts, 28 female crotches, and 6 male members. A total of 1 hour and 48 minutes of nudity, including orgies, incest, and rape. So this is the deep thought. This is the deep thought because, I mean, that's a lot of bosoms. That's by anybody's standard. And so David French should not be criticizing evangelicals on Trump because he's sitting there watching 134 nude bosoms. Okay, when's the last time you heard the word bosoms, by the way? I mean, just it's
probably this tweet, honestly, probably the screenshot of this tweet that I saw a couple of days ago.
Yeah, so anyway, this is the state of debate. I guess the serious point is that, you know, that evangelicals should feel okay about defending their support for a man of Trump's character because, you know, that David French is a hypocrite because he watches the show with female crotches, male members, and multiple naked bosoms. That's the serious point. Okay, so I'm sorry, Gideon, because I want to talk about the Democrats. So let's go from the I'm going to get dragged for this, from the boobs to the booing. Okay, so all or most of the Democrats went out to California to speak to the California Democrats, with the exception of Joe Biden. And interesting that he was a no-show there. But among the more interesting moments, John Hickenlooper from Colorado, John Delaney from Maryland, both had this moment at these convention at this convention.
Socialism is not the answer.
Okay, so big boos for Hickenlooper using the word socialism. So first of all, were they booing because they really disagree? They do like socialism, or were they mad at Hickenlooper for using the word socialism?
I think it's probably a mixture of both. And I think that it's also a reflection of people kind of being frustrated that the ideas that have taken hold, specifically you know, the two candidates that you mentioned are not for Medicare for all, and they're certainly not for it in the manner in which you know, Senator Sanders' bill would work, right? I think it's a lot of pent-up frustration that there is a desire from those candidates to talk about things like universal health care and use the, you know, S word label, if you will. So I think it's a mixture of both. And I think it's also just a notion of, like, you know, when you're at a convention like that, and this is, I've seen it in, you know, both Republican and Democratic contexts, when there's a person who, you know, tries to cut against the stream, if you will, of what everybody else is saying, I think that ends up prompting some negative reaction. But my understanding is that it's a combination of the element that they think that both of these guys are not serious about structural changes to healthcare, to the economy, et cetera, and so forth, and that they would be using what they deem to be, you know, Republican talking points, that if you talk about universal healthcare, then you're talking about socialism.
There are people who are talking about sort of socialist-y things, right? I mean, Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a part of the Democratic primary that is definitely sort of tiptoeing into a realm, you know, socialism, however you want to, you know, label it. And there are these other centrist candidates that are kind of looking at where they're at in terms of polling, where they're at in terms of interest, where they're at in terms of fundraising, and they're saying, maybe the best option for me is to more explicitly cut against some of the leaders of the pack here. At the same time, you know, the person that we've seen at the top of most of these early polls, with, you know, the huge caveats being that at this point you don't know if Biden is a Hillary Clinton, or if he's a Rudy Giuliani, or if he's, you know, something in between in terms of how these early numbers look. But the person who is leading every single bit of data that we have so far is also making the case in different terms, and probably with more tact, than, you know, a Hickenlooper or a Delaney.
Yeah, okay. So Hickenlooper, I don't really know him really well. Was he surprised that he was booed, or did he go in there thinking that this was going to be a distinguishing moment, that this was kind of his, and this already, we're early in the campaign, but we've already started, you know, overusing the term, the sister soldier moment for him. I mean, did he do that intentionally?
Yeah, I think there was intention there. Yeah, absolutely. Because I think he's been along that track for quite some time now. You know, explicitly kind of taking some of the ideas that other folks have in the field. I mean, broadly talking about climate change, broadly talking about the economy, broadly talking about antitrust and monopolies, things of that nature. But I think this was a moment where they decided, and you see it also in the way that Congressman Delaney was arguing with Rep. Ocasio-Cortez on Twitter, that the thing for them right now is to try to bring out a little bit more attention, a little bit more media coverage by explicitly, you know, going against other figures in their party. Right. So I think that the booing aspect, excuse me, was either planned or not planned, but they anticipated it.
Okay.
They knew that this was going to be something that, you know, was going to cause some waves.
Okay. So Joe Biden, leading in almost all the polls, or all the polls that I know, you probably have seen different ones, decided not to go. So tell me about the thinking there, the Biden strategy, not feeling that he needs to say yes to the largest state in the country.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. I think that we don't know necessarily right now why this is happening, but I do have some guesses. And I think that part of it is, from the beginning of his campaign launch, what did we all see? We basically saw that he was talking exclusively about the president. He was talking for, you know, nearly half the ad or so about Charlottesville itself. This is a person who is looking past the primary and towards the general election right now. And one of the ways in which we can keep having this dichotomy where we talk about this pack of 22, 23 candidates and Joe Biden, one of the ways that you reinforce that dichotomy is by saying, okay, you all can go to this, and, you know, I'm going to do my events the way that I'm going to do my events. Now, the small downside that I see to that, and I don't know if this is something, you know, that has been discussed much amongst the team, if this is something that they're going to try to address, is these cattle calls, if you will, are a nice lower stakes opportunity to talk to people before the debates, right? And so if you don't have a lot of these kind of test runs where, you know, you're on stage for 5 minutes or so, followed by another person, and you know, before another candidate and after another candidate, then the first time you have that chance is at the debate. And it's fairly clear that a lot of these candidates are going to try to draw, you know, pretty significant contrasts with Biden. And I'm not saying that he won't be prepared for it, because, you know, he's been in these situations before, but it is interesting to me that they wouldn't want to necessarily give him those kinds of test runs in these lower stakes situations. Another example is you know, it's the Hall of Fame dinner in Iowa Sunday evening, and all the candidates are going, and he's not. He's coming to Iowa, you know, a day or two after. And it happens to be the same day that Trump is there for a fundraiser, I believe. And these things, I think, are a little bit strategic right now, but there's a plus, and there's a fairly significant possible minus, I think, too.
Well, he came out with a really, it looked, at least on the surface, and I'm going to admit that I have not read all the details of it, a pretty ambitious climate plan that talks about, you know, eliminating fossil fuel dependency by 2050, embracing the framework of the Green New Deal, and it certainly looks quite ambitious. What is the thinking there? Because if to the extent that Biden has been trying to position himself as a centrist, well, let me put it this way, you know, trying to position himself as a centrist, does this you know, accomplish that for him, or does it risk, eroding some of that branding for the general election in order to get through the primary, which was an inelegant way of asking the question, what do you think about this plan?
No, I totally understand what you're saying. It's interesting to me that a lot of the kind of progressive groups are saying, well, we pressed him on this and he listened to us, which I'm not sure is exactly what happened here. I think that with, you know, the climate plan specifically, they look at it as there is really not much of a limit in this Democratic primary for where you can go on your goals with climate. It's animating a lot more voters this time. It is polling is one of the top issues for Democratic primary voters for sure. And so the calculus here is maybe it behooves us to go a little bolder here than we would elsewhere possibly, because people are going to accept essentially any plan right now. Another example is
Democrats are willing to accept it.
Democrats, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
At a certain point, I mean, we can't predict how climate is necessarily going to play into a general election process, because it's obviously clearly not something that interests the president or that he buys into, frankly. But within this primary, I think that those are actually the spots where a lot of these folks are going broader and bigger than they would on some of the other issues. Senator Michael Bennett's another example, where he actually had a climate proposal out that was pretty expansive as well a couple of weeks ago, I think. And he's not a person who is for Medicare for all. He's a person who is explicitly against a lot of what Senator Sanders is talking about. So in essence, to sum up my rambling, I apologize. I think that what the Biden folks think with something like this is at a certain point, you do have to listen to the people who might be saying, hey, make sure you're running a campaign in 2019 versus 2008. Right. But obviously apply the limitations where you think are best. And on climate, it definitely seems like the conversation is going farther, faster among, you know, a lot of voters and a lot of activists.
That's evident. And I guess what surprised me a little bit is that somebody like Joe Biden's been around long enough to know how the Republican counteroffensive will play in states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Ohio, because you know that there's $100 million of ads that will talk about the jobs, the manufacturing jobs that will be put at risk, the taxes that will be raised, and all of that. So, I mean, this is going to be, you know, a major, I would guess, a major source of attack lines from the Trump folks and from Republicans in general. And we've seen how effective that can be. The climate often will poll very high when it's aspirational, but when you put a price tag on it and when people think that it's going to, you know, result in job loss or job dislocation, those numbers change. And you know, the Australian election being one example, but also watching even in some more progressive states like Washington, where they've had referendums about things like you know, a carbon tax, that have not gone well. So this is not without risk for Joe Biden.
Yeah, and I think that the other part that a lot of folks might be thinking about is the president will likely say those things anyway, right? And the advertising will likely include those things anyway. So, you know, there's a counter argument to a lot of the risks and potential pitfalls in this primary, which is that, and you hear this a lot from the folks who are, you know, more on the left, if you will, the spectrum is kind of all over the place, but for the purposes of this dialogue, it's people that are more on the left saying, well, listen, the president is going to say that any candidate who makes it through this, whether it's somebody like John Delaney or somebody like Bernie Sanders, that they just want to, you know, tax you to death.
Right.
That
they'll say it anyway.
They're going to give away. Yeah. And so, you know, I don't know how much that does play into how Biden thinks about this prospective matchup. I have to assume that he also thinks that, you know, the prior history of being a person who speaks to quote unquote white working class, if you will, that he would be able to communicate that. I don't know. Frankly,
I think you make great points. It's coming anyway, and he probably is immunized a little bit. You know, I know that it's unfashionable to cite, you know, things that are happening in the real world as possibly having some political significance, but it couldn't help think when I was we're talking about climate, this story that's really not broken, but that we've been reading about over the last 24 hours about what's happening in the Corn Belt because of the weather. The headline in the Washington Post is, after a biblical spring, this is the week that could break the Corn Belt. Through all of April and all of May, wave after wave of rain hit the nation right in the breadbasket, with April capping the wettest 12 months on record. And as a result, the planting of acreage of corn is down dramatically. And David Frum pointed out, you know, in a different era, this a potentially mass crop failure of this magnitude would be a huge story. Now it's just sort of on the side. The reason I'm bringing this up is if people begin to associate things like that with climate change, does it change the dynamic of the issue? And you know, who knows? Because we've never really had to confront something, you know, very sort of, you know, A plus, you know, I mean, A to B, look what just happened because of climate. Now, again, I'm not a climate scientist, and I don't know, you know, whether there's a straight line, but you could certainly see that narrative developing. Or am I reaching too much here?
No, I think that's right. And I mean, we're probably all reaching when we're trying to figure out, you know, what's going to happen day to day. But no, I think there is a point to be made there, right? Which is that, you know, a lot of, take Iowa just as an example on its own, major portions of the state have just been completely flooded for, you know, a huge span of time this year in a way that either people are going to think hasn't happened before or truly hasn't happened before. And to unpack that for a second, I think that, you know, if you're a person there who is inclined to, be interested in Democrats. Let's say you were an Obama to Trump voter, right, or you know, you were a non-participant and then you were a Trump voter, and climate change is something that is important to you because of your livelihood and your safety and your location, et cetera, and so forth. It may seem like it is a more severe moment because more people are talking about it and because you're experiencing it. And that might mean that there's been flooding in your area before and that it's worse now because of climate change, or it might be a combination of that fact and the fact that, you know, you're hearing about it more. It seems like it's a cycle that's kind of feeding into each other a little bit right now.
So it might appeal to the blue curious voter. Not Democrat. We got to move past Democrat Republican leaning. We have to have curious, you know, Democrat curious voters who might be attracted to that sort of thing. Well, who knows? Okay, I want to move on to Mayor Pete because, I don't think he's going to be the nominee, but I think he's certainly the most interesting guy. What do you make of his comments about Al Franken, saying that he would not have pushed for Al Franken to resign from the Senate? Of course, Al Franken being one of the very, very earliest political casualties of the new Me Too wokeness, and now Mayor Pete's going, yeah, I would cut the guy some slack for the groping.
It was an interesting position to take for him. I think that what he was trying to say at the beginning of the statement, and he has an interesting way of communicating in a lot of these settings where there are these sort of long paragraphs that he gives. And if you look at the paragraphs and you take a line from it, you can make a headline of it, and it seems like a different thing than, you know, if you took a line from later on in the paragraph. But I think that what he was saying at the beginning was that level of, let's call it accountability, if that's fair to say, in your own party, without going through a process by which, you know, there's a more extensive investigation, there is a hearing or something like that could eventually be used against Democrats, and that, you know, the Republican Party could argue in bad faith in particular cases, you know, and I think that, that part of that, I think it derives from the fact that, you know, there are other members of the Republican Party that haven't self-policed as well, if you want to call it that. So I don't know that there was any kind of larger point that he was making, but it was interesting that when he was pressed, he said, you know, at that time, if I were in that position, I don't think I would have done it. And frankly, a lot of the other senators may not have done it until they saw Senator Gillibrand be the first one who basically said, well, I've heard enough and I don't think he should be here.
And a lot of Democrats do not seem ready to forgive her for that. This does not seem to be the rocket fuel for her presidential campaign that maybe she was expecting it would be.
Especially in the kind of donor class, there are people who are still relatively frustrated by it. I think there was kind of a great personal attachment to someone like Franken who, you know, it wasn't that long ago that people were saying maybe a potential presidential candidate at some point down the road. And I think that the larger theme of it is almost like this latent desire to match what Democrats think that Republicans are doing when they kind of play dirty, when they're not really being holier than thou necessarily, when they're not morally policing themselves. I think they look back and with hindsight say, I wish that we could kind of do the same sometimes. I think that that's where it kind of stems
from. Yeah, no, in the context of the moment, though, you had Roy Moore, who was running for the Senate. It wasn't clear that he was going to lose that. It looked like Roy Moore, you know, the conventional wisdom was that Roy Moore was going to win that. And then there would be a big debate in the early part of that year. And I can certainly understand why Democrats at that time wanted to clean up their act, because they figured that they were going to really be able to put this to Republicans. And then, of course, Roy Moore didn't cooperate and he went down to defeat, although he may come back. But, you know, again, I think both parties, everybody hates both sides, both parties are trying to wrestle with, you know, how do you calibrate your tactics? You know, how aggressive should you be? And I think there is kind of a downward spiral. Oh, you know, I was almost going to forget to ask you about all this. What the hell ever happened to Howard Schultz?
Yeah, that's very interesting. So
I actually had him on my podcast, and then I sort of noticed that he disappeared.
We reported, I'm trying to remember now when it was, it might have been last month or the month before, that there was a time when we would get these emails that basically said, you know, Howard Schultz is going to go to Arizona today. He's going to talk a little bit about immigration. He's going to listen to some experts, et cetera, and so forth. It was like a brief, seeming more like a campaign type of thing after his initial book tour. And then we were told that he actually had back surgery. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, during that time, a lot of the ads had also stopped on Facebook. There was the one that people made a great deal of fun of that one weekend. And I'm trying to remember what the phrase was exactly. It said something like, most of us Americans are Americans, or something like that. Don't quote me on that, but that's, you'll find it if you look it up. Okay. And after that whole span, it basically dropped off. And now, we were told the official reason was, you know, because he had the surgery. I think that the secondary part of this, frankly, is a lot of what he talked about before he was going to, you know, officially declare, which we had heard would be this summer, could still happen. So, you know, we'll see. Was that he didn't want to see the Democratic Party put up somebody who he thought could not win. And what he meant by that was, you know, a lot of the folks who are kind of ranked like second to fifth right now in polling. With Biden being the person to beat at this current moment, I think it's a harder sell for him to say that there needs to be this other option.
It kind of blows his rationale a bit.
Yeah, or at least, you know, if he did get in now, he would have to recalibrate a little bit of why he's saying he's doing it. Because if we had an election today and he got in as an independent and he qualified and he was on the ballot, et cetera, you would have a three-way race between, well, you know, absent a libertarian candidate, absent, et cetera, you'd have a three-way race between him, Trump, and Biden. And then that makes it a way harder sell if you're Schultz to, you know, sure, find this contingency of voters that he thinks would even, you know, come that way.
Hey, and by the way, I looked up the Facebook ad you mentioned before, and yes, the line was, quote, "the majority of Americans are Americans," unquote, which, by the way, is true. See, you get in trouble these days. It is demonstrably true. I could fact check that, rate it true. Majority of Americans are indeed Americans. So
right. There was nothing factually inaccurate. Yeah. I think that, you know, people looked at it and thought that might not be the best slogan that you could necessarily come up with, but, you know, keep working at it.
Okay. So the other problem that Democrats have is figuring out what to do with impeachment. And it's interesting to me that every time I say to a Democrat about what's going on right now, you know, gosh, you guys are really bad at politics, the response I always get is people go, oh, yeah, I know. It's just they shake their heads. Very clearly have not figured out how to handle this. The report is now that they're going to go through the sort of faux impeachment process. They're going to bring in John Dean to testify, which will remind everybody, we'll have all that Watergate-y vibe type thing. But you hang out with these. Is this going to satisfy the progressive base that wants impeachment to sort of go through the motions at this point? Do you see, is Nancy Pelosi going to be able to hold the line on this?
Part of me thinks no, because I think that they have not come up with, like you're saying, in terms of the pure political angle, I think that they have not come up with a viable rationale as to why they should not do it beyond it will fire up the Trump base and polls, right? Well, the response to that from a lot of people is, why don't you just decide if you think it's morally right or not to do, right? We had the report that came out. We had the statement from Mueller basically reiterating the report. And, you know, I think most people interpreted a not so subtle nudge to say, you know, hey, Congress, it is your job now or your decision to make. So that leaves a lot of people, you know, Democrats and voters within the primary process alike, who are sort of saying, well, if he said so, then like, why not? You know? Mm-hmm. And again, the counter when everybody talks about, you know, the Trump base, that Trump will talk about this, et cetera, and so forth. The counter is that he, and I know I said this before, but it really is true that he'll say it anyway. So what people are kind of thinking and saying to their members at this point is, you got to decide, like, yeah, do you think that this is right or wrong? You saw Mueller and you saw Congressman Amash making the case to a crowd in his district that was, and again, I don't know, you know, I don't know what the exact makeup of the district is, but it's not a deep blue area. Mm-hmm. Standing ovations and saying, this is, we like this. So
yeah,
it makes it so much more of a harder sell for the Democrats to try to figure out what it is that they want to do, unless the true strategy here is to just kind of poke at the bear over and over and over again until the president does something else. But at this point, it's like, you know, at this point, the response to them would be what else, essentially?
Yeah, I mean, I think the real problem is that their lack of a strategy has enabled the White House to get the initiative here, and they, you know, with the incredible assistance of the Attorney General, have turned, you know, the narrative into there was nothing there, there was no collusion, there was no obstruction. We're going to investigate the investigators. And, you know, to be concerned about the Trump base being riled up, it's hard to imagine a 2020 scenario in which both of those bases are not riled up. So you do wonder whether or not the risk is as great as the conventional wisdom suggests it is. But who knows? We will not know. Gideon Resnick, thank you so much for joining me. Gideon Resnick is the national political reporter for The Daily Beast covering Democrats. Thanks for the time today.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.